All right, so Rav Tovim, Erev Tov in Israel, where Rav Matthew Nitzanim is, and I want to welcome him, making his debut on Torah Motion. I guess I can thank my son Ariel, who suggested that I invite him to speak. I think you're finishing your PhD in bioethics. Is that?
I wish. I'm finishing my master's in bioethics right now.
Oh, you're finishing your master's. But he is teaching at Yeshivat Eretz HaTzvi and Midrashat Adumim in Yerushalayim. He has graduated a degree from bioethics from Bar Ilan, I guess a bachelor's, a degree in philosophy from Princeton, and clinical pastoral education from Penn Medicine, plus got smicha from the Rabbanut of Eretz Yisrael. And as you heard, for those who are here, been living in Israel for the last 4 years, and we want to welcome in for next number of weeks. We'll be talking about what to expect in the world of expecting the many of the halachic issues that arise. So, Bakashav Rav Nitzanim, pleasure to have you. We should hear good news from Israel. That's what else can we say? And hope our learning should be a schut for the Jewish people. Okay, Bakashav.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. Thank you for having me. Thank you to all of you who are here learning with us. It's really a pleasure to be joining with you for some time for Torah. Rabbi Kelman really already said as much as there is worth saying about myself, but maybe a few words of introduction before we get to today's content. Number one is, it is a remarkably unusual time to be talking about issues in fertility or really anything other than the ongoing situation in the Middle East, in Eretz Yisrael. It's certainly in the circles in which I sort of spend my time, that's really taking up all the focus. And there's something unusual and difficult, though everyone's sort of shifting to going about with the rest of the things that make up our lives. But nonetheless, I certainly hope that this learning can be a prayer as well, right? Rabbi Nachman of Breslov and his teaching talks about how we can turn our Torah into a tefillah, our learning into prayer. And so this learning should be a prayer that it should be not long until we can shift our focus away from taking our children out of the world and instead put our focus into bringing children into this world. And it should be a prayer for the many, many babies, young children who are against their will, the victims of tremendous horrors. And so we're praying for them all. That's number one. Number two is I want to acknowledge that if we're talking about fertility issues, there's a lot of really interesting halachic, ethical material to talk about, but there's no getting away from the fact that we're talking about issues that really touch people's lives. Perhaps someone who's with us today, or whether first degree, second degree, someone in our community, someone in our family. These are real issues that people have to navigate, what sorts of choices to make in terms of fertility treatment, what are the costs of fertility treatment, financial, emotional. And so this learning is a prayer for all of them as well, for those who are navigating their own journey through family building, that we're thinking of them as well. Okay, all that on the table, I think ready to learn some Torah. So what are we going to do here for the next few weeks? What's really interesting for me, being based in Israel and having done my studies in bioethics here in Israel, is that issues around fertility treatment, that which has to do with the making of babies, really gets a lot of attention in the state of Israel. And in fact, global bioethics discourse pays a great deal of attention to what happens in Israel when it comes to fertility treatment, because Israel, though a Western culture with a Western socialized system of medical care, is somewhat unique in its what we'll call pronatalist approach and culture. There's just a lot of pro attitudes towards babies for any number of reasons. That's especially true among the Jewish population, though even among the Arab population, birth rates are higher than what we might find in Europe, North America. And because of that, a lot of the questions around how to navigate emerging issues in fertility treatment, ethical questions, policy questions, they often come up first in Israel. And because of that, a lot of the discourse, even in the US, Canada, in Europe, oftentimes researchers, scholars will look to precedent from Israel to see how they should navigate emerging issues. And so in that sense, there's a lot of talk in Israel around these sorts of issues, the ethics around fertility treatment. And I would certainly hope that the Torah is a part of that conversation in one way or another. There's a lot of sort of background meta discussion we could have around what ought the role or the voice of Torah be in thinking about policy issues in ethics. But we'll take as a given that we care what the Torah has to say, even if we can acknowledge that the Torah doesn't exactly address issues like cryopreservation or in vitro fertilization, all sorts of new technologies where we hope that the Torah and Judaism, our tradition, God, knows that we have all these questions, but at the same time won't address issues directly. We'll have to figure out sort of methodologically, what do we do with all that? So that's our goal in this course, is to look at some of these emerging issues, questions that have arisen over the last, say, decade or so, or at least have been taken on new meaning in the past decade, some issues which are still emerging to this day as we think about fertility treatment and the various halakhic and ethical issues that that might come up. So that's our goal for this course. And today we're talking about surplus pre-embryos. Okay, so I'm in a moment I'll share the screen, but I want to first just make a minor point about terminology. What we're going to be talking about today is embryos, meaning the little organisms, I guess, that with time can develop into, I guess, really any animal, but in our case we're focusing on humans. We're at the very, very early stages. You know, we have their sperm, egg, they're joined together, and they develop into a few more cells. We call that, we're talking about this very early stage. There's a debate whether we should refer to this as an embryo or a pre-embryo. Now, I'm going to use the term pre-embryo as we go along, but you should just understand what I mean by that is an embryo in an early stage. The question of what is the status of these things will occupy our attention for today's shiur. And so the question of its status is really tied up with what do we call it? Do we call it a full-fledged embryo, a pre-embryo? Some people insist on the term fertilized egg, don't want to use the term embryo. So I'm going to use the term pre-embryo, but you'll know what to expect. Okay, so that with having that established, let's take a look at the sources and the questions that we want to look at. So I'm going to share the screen. If I can just get a thumbs up that you see the screen that I'm sharing. Amazing, amazing. All right, I appreciate that. So let's get started. I'm going to make sure this is working. Okay, so what we're talking about today is really an element or an outgrowth of the IVF process. IVF has been around for a few decades, and is a method by which, just for review, for people who are haven't been in the know, more recently, IVF, what it entails is doing the fertilization, namely getting the sperm into the egg, which eventually can turn into an embryo and into a fetus, into a baby, having it happen in vitro, meaning not in vivo, in life, namely within the human body, but rather in vitro in a laboratory setting. So what's involved is that there can be people who, for any number of reasons, are struggling to have a start a pregnancy in this sort of natural way. And so what can be done is eggs can be removed from a female body, sperm from a male body, and they can be fertilized in a laboratory by specialists and then grown into embryos. And then the embryos can be placed back into a human womb so that it can be born into a child. That's what's involved in IVF. Now, this has been really a remarkable technology, which has allowed a huge number of children to be born who otherwise would not have been able to, families to be able to have children of their own. There are various estimates of how many IVF babies there are alive today. We don't have a precise number, but it could be north of 1 million at this point. Huge, huge numbers of children who are alive today. But there are questions that come up all through the process. One of the questions focuses on what happens after through this process of making the embryos. Generally, what happens in order to make sure that eggs can be used, retrieved for the fertilization, is that there's ovarian stimulation to cause the body, the female body in this case, to produce eggs. a fair amount of eggs. And then generally speaking, multiple eggs are retrieved and fertilized, in recognizing that it might not be that all of the embryos will take hold, right? There could be some issue with the fertilization and so on. And so generally speaking, when people go through the IVF process, they create multiple embryos. It varies from one jurisdiction to another, from one lab to another, from one clinic to another. But it's not uncommon that in one round of IVF, you could be making 5, 6 embryos. When in fact, most of those families that want to have a baby are generally going to prefer to make one at a time. And so you end up making, let's say, 5 or 6 embryos, and then one is implanted into the womb. Let's say that works. A pregnancy starts. That's great. But now that we have, let's say, 5 leftover embryos, what are we going to do with them? Okay, they have all the genetic material necessary to become a full-fledged human. But at the moment, it's just a collection of, I don't know, a handful of cells. Depends on exactly the point at which the freezing is done of the surplus embryos, the extra ones. But it could be 12 cells, maybe 20 cells. And that's it. Now, again, if you were to take that embryo and put it into a human womb and everything goes well, that could become a human. But right now, it's, you know, microscopic. It's a handful of cells. And now there are extra. What do we do with them? This has been a major issue for quite some time. I guess really since the birth of IVF as an available technology, though the questions have changed somewhat in recent years. So what can you do with these surplus embryos? What are the options available to you? So one option is, as in certainly there are couples who might want to have multiple children, and so they'll hold on to their surplus embryos over the course of time so that they can perhaps later on have another child or another child. The process of holding on to these embryos requires freezing them in specialized high-tech freezers that are available at all sorts of clinics around the world, generally at cost. It's not cheap to keep these things in freezers. And so, generally speaking, there will be some sort of cost involved, and you can just hold on to them. But at some point, you might make the determination that you're done having children of your own. And the question is, what do you do with surplus embryos? Excuse me. So the first option is certainly disposal. You could just throw them away. You could drop them in a trash can and call it a day. That's going to be our focus for today. Is that a live option for someone who cares about observing halakha, for someone who cares about being honest to the Jewish tradition? Is it a valid option to take these embryos? Again, teeny tiny nothings of cells, but they could be babies if put into the right circumstances. Are you allowed to just throw that away? So that's one option. One option is disposal. Option number two is donation for research. There is certainly value to using embryos for various forms of pre-embryonic research, stem cell research, which is done in all sorts of places. There's been a great deal of debate around this for decades in the U.S., as we'll discuss in a moment. There, in theory, is the option of donation for implantation, where you could take these extra embryos and offer them to other either women or families who are interested in having children. That obviously involves what we might call a possible awkwardness, if not more than that. There, you would have your biological children handed off to someone else, born to someone else, right? As in, it's a little bit different from donating sperm or donating an egg, where generally speaking, those are using sperm or eggs from donor banks are contributing some of their own genetic material. And here, let's say we're talking about a married couple. You made an embryo that has your shared genetic material and just handing it off to someone else to make a baby out of. So that certainly could be awkward or uncomfortable. And in some jurisdictions, there are serious limitations on that. For example, in the state of Israel, it's at the moment not a live option. It's illegal to do so. Though in the US and Canada, there are ways to go about it. And so that's certainly an option with the upside of being able to support families who want to have children. On the other hand, it can be complicated, or how do we think about parenting? Now, you could just hold off on this question and just go for perpetual freezing. Just keep them in the freezers forever. The obvious downside is that would cost a great deal of money, as we already said. However, I think, I have this here. In the state of Israel, we'll go back to the slide, that slide in a moment. In the state of Israel, this is what is happening, which is why this is a really pressing issue in Israel. There's been a lot of discourse around it just in the past few years, some research groups dealing with it, including one that I was involved with at Bar-Ilan University. In the state of Israel, although technically by law, after, I believe, it was originally 5 years, then it was turned to 10 years, after a couple has stopped using their embryos if or pre-embryos and they can't be found, they can't be contacted, the state has the right to get rid of them. But the clinics throughout Israel have refused to get rid of any frozen pre-embryos for fear that there might be some sort of, the parents will come looking for them, it's wrong to kill these children, if we're going to use that language, kill children. And so for that reason, there are over a million frozen pre-embryos costing the state millions and millions of shekels, because in Israel, freezing eggs and freezing embryos is covered by state insurance, by state health insurance. And so the state is shouldering the bill, the tax shekels of the people of Israel is shouldering the bill of all these frozen pre-embryos. And so this has been a real issue in Israel, and why there's been a lot of talk about can we consider other options. Now, in North America, the greater sort of push comes from certain Catholic and evangelical circles, where there's a strong belief that life, human life, starts at conception. Now, the point at which you meet a pre-embryo, you know, when it's sitting in one of these freezers at a fertility clinic, is not long after conception. We're like, you know, we're only 10 or 12 cells away from conception. You know, it's only been an hour or two, or maybe maximum 2 or 3 days. But according to some conceptions, especially within the Catholic and evangelical worlds, that is considered a person. And so to throw that away, to dispose of that pre-embryo, is to kill a person. For that reason, there's been a push in some evangelical circles to go to these various clinics in the U.S., find the pre-embryos, and give birth to them. Find some way to bring as many to life as possible. So much so that in 2017, it was reported that there was a woman who, from an evangelical family, her name is Tina Gibson, and she found a pre-embryo that had been frozen for 24 years in the clinic. And she had the clinic agree to give it to her because the original genetic parents were no longer available or no longer interested. And she gave birth to that baby. It was at the time, it was the longest that a pre-embryo had stayed frozen before being born. Since then, I think there was one more that was even a little bit longer, I think 26 years. And there was a movement to do that. Now, if nothing else, that's not a long-term plan, because there are probably not enough willing birthing mothers for the literally around the globe millions of these pre-embryos. But it certainly raises the question of what are we meant to do with these pre-embryos? Okay. Now, before we continue, maybe I'll even stop the share for a moment. I'm curious to hear from the crowd whether we want to share from personal experience or what you might imagine. I'm in the interest of time, I'm going to go for a show of hands. So for those of you who are on screen, can you plausibly imagine that if you had surplus pre-embryos, right? You went through the IVF process, you had the number of children that you want to have, you have some spare. Your options are disposal, donating to some other family, or donating to research. By a show of hands, can you imagine, entertain the possibility of donating them for the purposes of research? Okay, all right, it's an option. Can you imagine the possibility of donating those pre-embryos to some other family to have a child? Interesting. So unsurprisingly, yeah, so the statistical research that was done in Israel just in the past year is that there are actually a similar feeling that people are maybe open to it, though with some hesitation. You know, on the one hand, it produces a sense of solidarity, especially among families who have gone through these difficult fertility journeys together, or which is in tandem, right? Gone through similar experiences. But it's also a funny thing to think about someone else having your biological genetic child. And so it's tricky to think through, again, on a personal level, what would one be willing to do? So now what our focus for today is going to be on disposal. Is disposal really an option? And the possibility of donating to another family, which is connected to these larger issues of what happens when genetic material gets shared, you know, between people related to questions of surrogacy and so on. We're going to get at that next week. For today, we're focusing on the question of disposal. Is disposal an option? All right, so I'm going to go back to the screen. Again, ask for a thumbs up if you can see the screen that I'm sharing, the slides. Fantastic. All right. So let's start with some traditional sources. Broadly speaking, when we look at the halakhic tradition, and again, I hope you'll bear with me. We don't have the time in our approximate hour long session to go through the vast wealth of literature that is available, but I certainly took points that I think are especially relevant and accessible for this particular conversation. So in the halakhic tradition, broadly speaking, there's a notion that until approximately 40 days, approximately exactly 40 days after conception, whatever the embryo or pre-embryo is, it doesn't really count. It doesn't have the full-fledged status of a person. Right? That's implied in Mishnah, Masechta Nidah, right? That a fetus is not considered to be formed, right? To have taken on the status of a fetus, of a person. A person is a funny term to use. Let's say that it doesn't take on the status of a fetus until at least 40 days after conception. And the Gemara in Masechta Yevamot uses the formulation of Maya Be'alma. It's just water. It's just fluid, right? That you can't say there's a thing there. It's a good question, and discussed by both historians and postgame. What did everybody think happened at the 40-day mark? What was significant about 40 days? What is it that was presumed to have happened regarding the development of the fetus, that which parts of the body are present? But regardless, until then, it seems pretty clear it's not a full-fledged person. These are sources which are especially relevant when it comes to questions of abortion. As a general rule, those rabbinic figures who are open to the possibility of abortion have a strong preference that it happened prior to 40 days after conception. But that would certainly seem to imply, even if we have questions what exactly that means in terms of, you know, could there be a fetus who's 38 days but might already be a person, the little teeny tiny pre-embryos that you can't even see, that definitely feels like it should be Maya Ba'alma. That's not a fetus. That seems to be, consonant with this voice in the rabbinic tradition. And in fact, in the writing that does exist about this question of of surplus embryos, those rabbis have written about it, Rav Chaim David Alevi, Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein, Rav Asher Weiss, have all basically said the same thing, or touching on in their respective ways this notion of the 40 days, right? So here's Rav Chaim David Alevi writing in 1990. When any fertilized pre-embryos, which are still in the laboratory, they have no status whatsoever of fetus. And Shabbat may not be desecrated for their sake, right? As a general rule, we say that the Shabbat can be desecrated, right? You can break the laws of Shabbat in order to save a life. There's an interesting view, which is broadly accepted within halakha, that even a fetus, before it is born, you can desecrate Shabbat to save a fetus. But Rav Chaim David Alevi says that would not apply to these pre-embryos, you know, these little things sitting in freezers. And here's the money line. Mutar lizor kan in lo nivcheru l'hashtala. They can be thrown away, right? These zrok is literally to throw in the trash. If there aren't chosen for implantation, mishum she'ein din hapala ela meirechem isha davka. Because the prohibition on abortion only applies once the embryo is in the womb. That seems as straightforward as it needs to be. Very clearly, the prohibition on abortion can't possibly apply to these cells sitting in laboratories. He says it can't be. And therefore, if you want to, just throw them away. Mutar lizorka. Similarly, says the Sheva Halevi in a tshuva from more or less the same time, again, along the same lines, pshita de'adain enu nikra nefesh, right? On the third line of the Hebrew, It is clear that it's such a this embryo or pre-embryo is not considered a nefesh, a soul or a person at that point, such that there would be a prohibition of killing, of abortion. Rak kizera, the little cloud kubar, it's seed. Just it's the stuff that we use to make people, but it's not a person. So that really should end the conversation there. There is halakhic conversation around this question: can you destroy these pre-embryos? And everybody who seemed to talk about it, at least in the earlier, seemed to say, yeah, no problem, because there's no way that we can call it abortion, right? If you take a strong view of conception, as is common in the Catholic or evangelical worlds, right? From conception onwards, you know, that's a person, you'd be stuck. But in the Jewish tradition, it seems pretty clear that we don't presume that person, it starts from the time of conception. And at this point, when you have, I don't know, 20 cells joined together, you know, maybe a blastocyst, right? Sitting in a teeny tiny, you know, tube in a freezer, that is not a person. But the conversation gets a little more complicated. In 2016, there was a couple in Israel that was, as I recall, was getting divorced. And they previously had gone through IVF in order to produce embryos that they could use for implantation to start a pregnancy. Now, the major precedent throughout the world in bioethics discourse, in legal discourse, around what happens when a couple makes embryos and then gets divorced, right? Which of them is entitled to keep the embryos? Can either of them use the embryos or the pre-embryos? I'm sorry. The precedent case is called Nachmani v. Nachmani, a case that came up before the Israeli Supreme Court. And to date, it remains the case in the before the Israeli Supreme Court, which has had the largest panel of judges adjudicate the case. If we ever get around to in the state of Israel, the court case that was supposed to come up about dealing with the legal reform, that one will win and we'll have a larger panel. But until then, Nachmani v. Nachmani is still the biggest. So there's a lot of literature in Israeli halachic and legal writing about what happens in this case where a couple is married, they make embryos, and they get divorced. Who gets the embryos? But here the question was a little bit different, which came up in 2016 before the Dayan Rav Yair ben Menachem, where the couple knew that they were separating. They knew they did neither of them was going to use these pre-embryos. But they figured the best thing to do is just destroy them, right? At this point, that they might as well. But they had this hunch, this inkling. Something about that seems wrong. It feels like it shouldn't be okay to take these pre-embryos and toss them in the garbage. And so they went before the Dayan, before the rabbinic judge, Rabbi Yair ben Menachem, who serves on the Tel Aviv Rabbinical Court, he still does. And they asked the question, they said, neither of us wants these. We want to throw them out, but we just want to check. Is it okay to throw them out? Now, as he points out, very few people have asked that question, meaning even those who've written previously, as we saw, the Shevet Alevi, Rav Uzner, as well as Rav Chaim David Alevi, they were writing in the abstract and said there's nothing wrong throwing them out. But here we had a real case of a couple asking a rabbi, is it okay to throw out to dispose of the pre-embryos? And so he has this very long discussion of whether it's permissible, and he writes as follows. I'm going to read this one in English. And it seems to me to apply the halacha similarly in this case. And if, in fact, the fear of God has touched the hearts of the spouses, they should withhold by any means from instructing the fertilized pre-embryos be actively destroyed. And we as rabbis should surely shouldn't instruct so either. For it is clear from the sources cited in his previous discussion, how much our saintly sages took care to avoid any possible destruction of seed that bears the possibility of life. Continuing, and although the fertilized pre-embryos do not yet have the status of souls nor the prohibition of abortion, right, as we already established, nonetheless, here's the key, the prohibition on destroying seed would extend to destroying the pre-embryos or instructing as such. Says Rabbi Yair ben Menachem, we forgot about something. We forgot about another prohibition, not the prohibition of abortion, the prohibition on destroying seed. What is referred to as hashchatat zera levatala. So it's funny to be talking about that. It's funny to be talking about this destroying or wasting seed prohibition. Generally speaking, when we the conversation around this sort of issue touches on questions around the development of male sexuality, whether masturbation is what it means for it to be prohibited, how what sort of guidance should be given to prepubescent and pubescent boys, and yet, and there's I think you know all sorts of ways of navigating that, especially in our communities. And what I think is really interesting is that, as Rabbi Yehuda Menachem points out, really when we talk about this question, there's some notion in the Jewish tradition, whatever we mean by it, that seed shouldn't be destroyed. If that is true for sperm cells alone, then certainly that should be the case for already existing pre-embryos. They have all the genetic material they need to become a baby, a person. And the truth is, I'm very struck by this because my sense is that certainly in some Jewish communities, there's a voice that is emerging that is skeptical about what is really so wrong about what we call wasting seed, right? This is really such a deep problem. But we do, I think, many people have some sort of intuition. In fact, this couple had this intuition, and many of us might have it also. There's something not so okay about taking pre-embryos and throwing them away. Right? If we have some notion in our tradition of not wasting seed, then it certainly should apply to this. Right? We share that intuition with our tradition. There's something a little bit off about taking this genetic material that has the capacity to become a child and throwing that away. And so Rav Ben Menachem has a lengthy discussion of the laws of destroying seed and argues that it should apply here as well. So for that, we have to do a bit of background about this unusual prohibition, one that we don't tend to talk about a lot, but seems really especially relevant here. Wasting seed, destroying seed. Okay. So as he already notes, the primary question we have to ask ourselves is, what does it mean when we say in our tradition that there's a prohibition on destroying seed? What really is the prohibition? Again, the kind of thing that we tend not to, talk about in halacha class, but really is what we're going to have to explore in order to make sense of this question. So as Rav Ben Menachem points out, there are primarily two sorts of voices, two schools of thought. As he presents it, reflected by the Rav Pa'alim and the Ben Ish Chai and the Chabot Ge'ir, two rabbis both writing in the, I guess we could say the modern period. Chabot Ge'ir is sort of early modern, Rav Pa'alim is, we'll already call modern. What is the prohibition? So the Rav Pa'alim writes as follows. Tzarich lomar, it must be the case. It can't be the case that the prohibition on wasting or destroying seed stems from the fact that there could have been a child, but now there won't be. Seemingly says that because it doesn't seem imaginable that could be the prohibition because in the course of life, right, in the course of marital relations, it is the case. We know that not all within the semen there is sperm that won't become a child. So it can't be that sperm not becoming a baby is itself a prohibition. He says it must be that the prohibition is on the removal of sperm from the body, ejaculation, not in the context of marital relations, that there's something wrong with that. There's some attempt to protect or ensure natural marital relations. I suppose between married people. And as long as that's what's happening, you're fine. And it can't be that any time that sperm goes to waste, that seed goes to waste, that is a problem. As Ben Menachem points out, if we take the Rav Pa'alim's line of thinking about what the prohibition on destroying seed is, then we can certainly say that there's nothing wrong with throwing away these pre-embryos because you have not done anything that diverges from the course of nature, right? This isn't, or you've done your best to try to make a baby. Maybe you even have made a baby in the process. At this point, there's nothing wrong per se with what you're doing. The fact that a baby, a person, won't be born from the pre-embryos is not itself the problem. When we talk about this prohibition on destroying seed, that refers to a particular, that doesn't refer to any time that a potential human doesn't make it to the full status of humanity. The problem is that not everyone agrees. And the Chavod Yair, in his Lincoln Shuvah, which in his case is actually dealing with the case of abortion, in trying to formulate what is the prohibition on abortion, because it's not so clear that abortion falls under the category of murder, of killing a person, right? Because a fetus might not have the full status of a person. But says the Chavod Yair, "Devadaya asur lechatchila ligrom mitah l'ubar." It certainly is the case that you can't directly cause the death of a fetus. "Delo adif mishochtei hayiladim." It constitutes the killing of a child. "V'ifligu biisur otzaat shichlazer v'atala." And the sages spoke at great length regarding the prohibition of wasting seed. "Shari ra'ui hu shemikul tifa yed mitzar zera kodesh." For from every drop there ought to be formed a holy child. Says the Chavod Yair, if the rabbis care so much, so he claims, about this not destroying seed, it must be because all seed is meant to be used for making children. All seed is meant to be used for making children. And so he says that the prohibition on abortion is just an expression of the prohibition on destroying or wasting seed. That is what the prohibition of abortion is. Right? He claims that abortion, even in cases where it doesn't fall under killing, right, as assuming we're talking about an early stage abortion, it would still fall under the prohibition of destroying seed. Namely, the Chavod Yair, unlike the Rav Pali, does not think that the prohibition on wasting seed is a prohibition on masturbation. He thinks that it's a prohibition on causing it to be, under any circumstances, that human gametes are caused to not create a human child. And if that's the case, right, and as he says, every last drop, and every last cell, and every last gamete, every last preembryo, as the Chavod Yair might say, every last one needs to be used to make a child, then you can't throw it away. So, to be clear, we have the option of adopting the Rav Palim's view and saying the prohibition on wasting destroying seed just doesn't apply to preembryos, but the Chavod Yair wouldn't say that. The Chavod Yair would say that we really do have a concern we have to consider. Rav Ben Menachem, following the Chavod Yair, says we have to find some other way to get around this because the prohibition of destroying seed does apply here, as he claims. So going back to Rav Ben Menachem's Psak Din, his halachic ruling on this issue before the Tel Aviv Municipal Court, Rabbinic Court of the Beit Din, he writes at great length about how it must be the case that it's not okay to destroy these fertilized pre-embryos that are sitting in the freezers. And then he says this. V'rak im timatze, see the bold, derech grama. Hare sheledat harav binyan zion in l'osra. So he says the only way we could figure this one out is if you can find a method of destroying the pre-embryos that is grama. Grama is a category that appears in a number of areas of halakha. For those who study Daf Yomi, right, we just started Baba Kama, right, when it comes to damages, the notion of grama, causing a result indirectly, is certainly an important category there and applies here as well. It says you have to find some way to cause them to be destroyed indirectly. We'll get, later on to how he thinks that could happen. Oh, alternatively, imi vakshu lismocha Rabbeinu Gaon HaKadosh Avni Nezer. We could perhaps alternatively could rely on the view of Avni Nezer. We'll see Avni Nezer shortly. Harish yichlu lasod zot aydei isha revaka. This is his chiddush. Maybe it would be permissible to destroy the preembryos if it's done by an unmarried woman. What? How exactly do we get around this? What he claims to be a prohibition of destroying seed, itself an extension of the prohibition of abortion, if the person working at a fertility clinic is an unmarried woman. So that's going to be an important question, but he has these two solutions, right? Despite the fact that he said very clearly, right, as we saw previously, that it should be prohibited to destroy these fertilized preembryos, he comes in and says, but you know what? We could find a way to allow it if you do it indirectly or via an unmarried woman. First of all, why is he trying to find a solution? If he thinks it's prohibited, tell us it's prohibited. And two, these are the solutions he came up with. Really good question. Now, he's really convinced of this, so much so that in these next two paragraphs, he claims that Rav Chaim David Halevi, whom we saw previously, Rav Chaim David Halevi was the one who said in 1990, it is totally fine to dispose of pre-embryos because they don't have the status of a fetus. And so just go ahead and throw them out, the Zorkan. So comes Rav Ben Menachem and says, what about the prohibition of destroying seed? Meaning Rav Chaim David Halevi there said, the prohibition of abortion doesn't apply. The prohibition of killing a person doesn't apply. And says Rav Ben Menachem, but you forgot about the prohibition of destroying seed. So much so that says Rav Ben Menachem in this last paragraph, I'm reading in the English, therefore it seems to me that at the very least we ought not allow their mere disposal. And perhaps he himself, he, Rav Chaim David Halevi, who said you can throw them out, perhaps he himself similarly meant that it should be done indirectly or by an unmarried woman. He says it must be that when he said you can throw them out, it meant the way that I think that it's okay. Through one of these two odd ways of doing so. Okay. So the Grama is, I suppose, a little easier to understand. Right? If there, as a general in the halachot of nizikin, of causing damage to property, in the halachot of Shabbat, right, and doing prohibited labors, as a general, we say that it is less prohibited to do a bad act, a prohibited act, if you do it indirectly. Right? There's a difference between walking up to someone's car with a sledgehammer and smashing it to pieces versus you, I suppose in this case, accidentally, you're playing ball on top of, in your yard, and you throw the ball and it lands in someone's car. Perhaps for a better example, we can, rather than damages, we talk about Shabbat, right? As a general rule, we say that on Shabbat, right, there are all sorts of things we can't do. But the Gemara discusses how, if you had a scenario where there was a fire, right? Something had caught on fire, and we're presuming that there's no life that's in danger, but I don't know, a box of clothes caught on fire. We're worried that maybe the fire could spread. So it says the Gemara, so try to put it out indirectly. Put some water around it, so eventually the fire will go out. So that's a general principle of halacha. If you find an indirect way, it's better. There's an interesting history of how this notion of Grama has been, co-opted in new ways in modern halachic writing, in ways that it wasn't sort of imagined previously, especially regarding electricity on Shabbat. Not our issue for today. But what about the unmarried woman? What is that? Let's have a look at the Avni Nezer. The Avni Nezer, writing in the late 1800s, was faced with a question where there was a man and a woman who were married for some time. They had tried to have children. There had been a dangerous pregnancies multiple times. The doctor had recommended to her that she should no longer, attempt to have children. And it would be dangerous for her to become impregnated. At the time they were recommending, there was a method of birth control that was being recommended, which involved, washing out the vaginal canal, after intercourse. And this couple approached Avni Ezer and asked, is this something which we're allowed to do? And there are questions involved around the broader issue of birth control. We won't, unpack all that right now. But in along the way, as he's discussing this issue, Avni Ezer writes as follows. Ulfiza shapir muzharet shelo lashkid zera, kevan shish la ba'al hi mitzuva al priya or viyashel ba'ala. So says Avni Ezer, you might have thought that only men are prohibited from destroying seed, and that women are not. And so, if this couple has intercourse, there's semen that's inside her body, and she removes it, there shouldn't be a problem because she doesn't have the prohibition on destroying seed. Only he, the husband, does. However, says Avni Nezer, this is sort of building upon a broader discussion within the Rishonim, the medieval commentators on the Gemara. He says, inasmuch as she, the woman, the wife, is married to him, the man, the husband, she is responsible for his mitzvah as well. If it is prohibited for this man to destroy seed, then she, his wife, can't be destroying this seed either, the semen either. So he says, by that logic, she should not be allowed to remove the semen from her body. V'chol zeh, says Avni Nezer, this would only be a problem if she herself inserts the cloth. He knows that we're talking about washing out the semen, but he's using the term, this cloth, the moch, which is the form of birth control discussed in the Gemara. But he's referring to this method of washing out. So he says, this would only be a problem if she herself, the wife, removes the semen. Ava, Ima imisha acheret she'ein la ba'al she'ina mitzvah al pi rav riva ve'ina ba'arvel pi rav riva. But what happens if you find another woman who is not herself? I'm sorry, let me take a step back for a moment. I forgot to clarify. Nebuchadnezzar is under the presumption, which he derives from a reading of the Gemara and Rishonim, that the prohibition of destroying seed is an extension of the positive commandment, the mitzvah, to procreate, to have children, which unusually is, on a standard conventional approach to halakha, only incumbent upon men. How anybody ever planned for only men to make babies? Anyone's guess, but on a traditional account of halakha, the obligation to procreate is only applies to men. And therefore, women are obligated. So that's the inferior argument that would lead to the conclusion that a woman, if the prohibition of destroying seed is an extension of the obligation to have children, then inasmuch as a woman is not obligated to have children, she has no prohibition of destroying seed. Says Abinazer, but if you're married to a man, then you're responsible for his obligation. But if you're just some other woman, in fact, you're unmarried, then you have no personal stake in the mitzvah of procreating. So you have no personal stake in the prohibition on destroying seed, and therefore it would be fine for her to do so. So he suggests that maybe the thing to do is to have some other unmarried woman come and take care of this birth control method. It's creative. It's certainly creative. What's remarkable is the next paragraph, which Rav Ben Menachem does not cite in his essay when he reaches the conclusion that we should find unmarried women in clinics to open up the doors of freezers to destroy the preembryos. He writes as follows in the second paragraph. Ach, afim hi be'atzma taflit. But even if she, the wife in the story, were to herself, take care of what would amount to the destroying of seed. The fianu dati ain't isur. She says, honestly, I think it's fine if she just does it herself. Because he says, according to the Tosafot and the Rosh, these Ashkenazi medieval commentators, they basically say what we saw in the Rav Pali, that the prohibition on wasting seed or destroying seed is only prohibition at the time of ejaculation. But after that, there is no such prohibition. Right? This prohibition on destroying seed has nothing to do with what happens to all the sperm cells, all the gametes out there. But it's a prohibition specifically on ejaculation. And as he says, "V'etamahu kilurin le'inayim u'nevinim." And this reasoning is a salve to the eyes for those who understand. You know, he recognizes that this line of reasoning allows far greater flexibility regarding birth control and fertility treatment and so on. So notice what happened. The Abinazer threw out this idea. Maybe it would be good if he found some unmarried woman who, so he claims, is not herself party to the prohibition on destroying seed to take care of the destruction. But he himself says, I don't really think you need that. It's fine. As if you're not just wantonly destroying seed, but it's in a particular context where there's a married couple, they tried to have children and so on, then it's fine. So what would lead Rav Ben Menachem to adopt the Avni Nezer and recommend that in fertility clinics in Israel, we find some unmarried woman to take care of the indirect destruction of preembryos? So here's where I want to get to, I think is the most interesting point in terms of how we think about bioethics. I think what the Rav Ben Menachem is up to is he's sort of resting upon what we might refer to as the moral function of ritual. The moral function of ritual is when a ritual functions as a placeholder for a locally inactionable set of values, thereby affirming that the action undertaken overrides but does not negate the given set of values. For reference, let's think about challah, eating challah on Shabbos. Just to summarize what is a sort of major issue in the halachot of brachot, of reciting brachot. In principle, the challah should be on the table when you say kiddush, because kiddush on Shabbat is meant to introduce the meal, and the challah is the centerpiece of the meal, so the challah should be on the table. The problem is that, according to the rules of brachot, if you have bread and wine in front of you, in theory, you should first say bracha on bread and then say bracha on wine. So what we do is we put the bread on the table, but then we do an additional ritual and we cover the challah. By covering the challah, what we're accomplishing is we really want the challah not to be on the table, but they have to be on the table. So rather than just pick a side, we're gonna try to do both. We're gonna do one, have the challah on the table, but engage in a ritual that allows us to keep hold in our minds of the alternate value or the alternate preference. You know, they may not be on the table. We can think of another example that in bioethics, the timer, right? There's Dr. Vardi Ravitsky, now the head of the Hastings Center, wrote a piece about the suggestion in Israel quite a number of years ago, which was never implemented, that respirators for patients in the hospital should be on Shabbos timers, the same way that you put your crock pot for the chalent on a Shabbos timer. So they thought they should put the ventilators on Shabbos timers, such that you never have, if there's ever a decision to take someone off of life support, you never have to take them off life support. Instead, you wait for the timer to clock out, and it's already off, and then you pull it out and don't reconnect it. For all sorts of legal reasons, this is never implemented. But the idea is that we don't want to take people off life support. Sometimes we have to take people off life support. So let's find a way that we can sort of hold both positions. I think that's what's happening here. I think Rabbi Yerba Menachem knows full well that we have no choice but to allow people to dispose of surplus pre-embryos. There's millions of them. There's no way they're all going to become babies. But on the other hand, he really feels like there's something not right about throwing away these pre-embryos. So what he insists on is that there must be a special way to do it. By insisting on destroying them only in the special way, namely, indirectly, right? What he has in mind is that instead of just throwing them away, you open the freezer until it reaches a temperature where the pre-embryos can survive, and then you throw them. By doing it indirectly and by an unmarried woman, what you've done is you've found a way to destroy the pre-embryos, but to maintain for ourselves the notion that this is not the kind of thing to take lightly. We don't think that these pre-embryos are nothing. We think that they are of value. And there's a part of us that wishes that we could have not destroyed them ever. But we have to destroy them, so we're going to destroy them in a special way, in a way that still gives some respect and honor to them. Right? And that way we can sort of hold in place both of these values. In the end, they get destroyed, but we did it in a way that reminds us that we're not doing so wantonly. We're doing it so with intention. I think that's what Rabbi Ben Menachem is up to, especially because, as we saw, his idea of having the unmarried woman do so, he takes an Avinezer who himself doesn't think you actually need an unmarried woman to help you with these various forms of birth control or fertility treatment and so on. Rabbi Menachem is looking for someone, somewhere in the rabbinic tradition that will offer a way to destroy these pre-embryos in a special way so that we can maintain both of our, all of our sets of values. I think this is a really important concept, in ethics broadly, especially in bioethics, where sometimes there are things that, where we have contrasting or even contradictory values, and we want to maintain them both, but we can only actually apply one. We can use ritual as a method for holding on to those other values as well. I want to get to one other point, which is a suggestion on how to think about this issue, offered by a teacher of mine, my thesis advisor, Dr. Noam Zohar, in a piece entitled "Divine Representations of the Value of Embryos." He suggests that maybe there's another way that we can think about the halachic or traditional language to be used for thinking about these pre-embryos. What is their status? And he suggests that it's true, we have this intuition. We can't just take these pre-embryos and toss them in the garbage. There's a potential human here. As he uses in his example, you certainly wouldn't want to take those pre-embryos and feed them to cats, right? They're a little too special for that. But they're also not exactly people, right? It's a handful of cells you can't even see. And he says, do we have any traditional language for talking about these things that are kind of human, but still not really? And he says, looking at the second paragraph, hence I want to suggest that it is emblematic of the divine in another way, these preambles. Not as an image, right? We'd say that the human body is created in the image of God. He says that these pre-embryos are not emblematic of the divine as an image, but as a name. In the halachic tradition, inscriptions of the divine name are endowed with holiness and require great respect. Perhaps, by analogy, similar respect might be due toward an early stage embryo. Because maybe the way to think about three emperors is not as being B'Tselem Elohim in the divine image, but rather they're like a divine name. It sort of points to the divine, but not as directly as the divine image. That has not this kind of sanctity of a human life, where, you know, we would do anything to save a life. It's like a divine name. It's special, right? When you write out God's name on a piece of paper or parchment, that's holy, it's sacred, but not in the same way as a human being. And he suggests that, you know, in looking through the halachot of the sanctity of divine names of the Shemot HaKadoshim, he suggests that we can think of this in a number of lenses. One is that the sanctity of a divine name depends on its context, right? Right. For example, Aleph Lamed He Yud Mem, which spells the word Elohim. The word Elohim sometimes refers to God and the sacred, but sometimes refers to Elohim Achirim, other deities who are not holy, right? So the meaning of the letters depends on the context in which it's made. Similarly, it might be that preambrios, it depends on what is the context, what was the context in which these preambrios are made, in a research setting, in a fertility clinic. Number two, what is the intention, right? If you write a divine name without intending for it to be holy, right? In the halachot of divine names, let's say you, someone who is an apostate writes the divine name, it's not considered sacred. So maybe the same thing. What was your intention in making these preambrios? Did you already have in mind that it might not be used to make a baby? And number three is overriding values. We have a notion in the halacha, right, from the ritual of the sota, right, as discussed in Sefer Bimibar, where God says, "Tov she'imachesh shemi alamayim." It is better that my name should be erased in water than that there should be strife between married people. Referring to the fact that as part of the sota ritual, God's name is written onto parchment as part of a text, and then that whole text is erased into the water. And so says the Talmud in the name of God, some things like family well-being are more important, can override the sanctity of divine names, right? As opposed to the sanctity of human life, which there's very little that can override. The sanctity of divine names can be overridden by other values like financial cost, emotional cost, and so on. So that's Professor Zohar's suggestion of how we might think about these preambles. I'll just share now that we have still five classes ahead of us, in which we'll discuss a lot of issues that fit within this larger picture of fertility treatment, because there's a lot that's left to be uncovered. In particular, next week, Bezrat Hashem will be talking about what happens in a case of misimplantation, right? When a family makes a preembryo, but then it gets put into the wrong womb. What happens in, who are the recognized parents? Which relates to the question of whether embryos can be donated, and we'll go on to talk about the cost of freezing eggs and embryos, right? Who's responsible for that cost, surrogacy, and so on. So well, there's a lot that we'll be discussing along these lines in the coming weeks. So I hope that you join us. In the last couple of minutes, I'd love to open up the floor if there are questions, comments, thoughts on what we discussed today. I guess if you wanted to say something, maybe raise a hand either physically or on the using the button.
There are quite a few things in the chat.
Wow. Got it. Oh, okay. All right. Let me try to get through that real quick. Let's see. So from the top, do stored embryos degrade after a while? The answer is no, it seems. Evidently, yeah, you can hold on to them for a while. So much so that, we have these cases 24 years later, they're still able to make a baby out of it. Obviously, it depends on the quality of the freezing and so on, but it's certainly plausible that they can last, you know, for at least a long time, maybe forever, but certainly a long time. Yeah, I see the comment from Naomi regarding that, like these the toss up around sharing embryos, donating embryos to other families. In fact, really, it's really complicated. Gail. Thank you for sharing from your own experience. These are the question of what are the a teacher of mine at Bar Ilan has done extensive research on the question of what should the rights of these future children be to getting information about their genetic parents, their genetic siblings. How much should they be entitled to know about their own genetic family? I'm just jumping down to see if there are questions that were raised. Could embryos be used by a surrogate for coupling to adopt? Yeah, that's has been discussed before. Okay, so I think I think that's most of the issues that came up here. If there are any other questions or concerns, thoughts to share. Great.
You've got to think about this. Got to absorb it.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot here.
I've been thinking about it for a long time.
I'm glad. Yes, Asher Stein.
Did I understand correctly that turning off the freezer is grandma? Or do you have to just stop supplying the liquid nitrogen? Like, how does grandma work in terms of actual physical reality?
So I will, I'll say as an aside that, until relatively recently in halakhic writing, nobody ever talked about trying to do things bigrama indirectly, right? There's discussion of what happens if something in baba kama, right? In damages, what happens if you accidentally cause something to happen or some result indirectly? But it's only relatively recently that, especially in Hilchot Shabbat, where we've introduced this idea that you could try to do something bigrama. You find an indirect way of doing it. And there's a lot of, discussion amongst poskim today about how valid is it as a concept. So if you try to do something indirectly, what does it mean that it was indirect? And so what Rav Ben Menachem suggests is that, right, the freezers have doors. And I suppose you have to add liquid nitrogen regularly, and so you could just fail to add the liquid nitrogen. But what he has in mind is that you open the door, and that will cause warmer air to get inside the freezer, such that you didn't destroy the embryos, you just opened the door to allow the air to come in. It borrows off of an idea in Hilchot Shabbat, related to letting wind or sunlight into a room to let plants grow. Is that considered direct or indirect? So that's what he has in mind in terms of the opening of the door. Good question whether we could find another method, and good question whether any of these methods really count as indirect. But that's what he has in mind. All right, we've passed the hour. I'm so glad that so many of you have joined for our learning today. Looking forward to continuing next week. The question of misimplantation of pre-embryos was a major case that came up in Israel just last year. There's a lot of talk about it. And moving onwards over the next few weeks, these halachic and ethical issues around fertility treatment. Thanks so much for being with us.